Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Alaikum, Namaste, Pak Sadnam, Sat Sri Akal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lilat Hayawase Yake. May everything be well with you as it is with me. Now, as I do every day at the start of class, I will recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. And so I would ask that you bow your heads and close your eyes and bring into your mind the memory of someone dear to you who has passed away. And in doing so, you'll honor that person's memory and life with the light of your own consciousness. Yishkadol v'yishkadash me rabo, bo modi v'ero kirase, v'yamlik melkase, b'kaya kon uv'yo makon, uv'kaya dekol beis Yisrael, ba'agalo uv'izman koryev ve'imru omein. Yehesh me rabo mevorak le'olam u'le'om omayo, yisparak v'yistabak v'yisparar v'yisramam, v'yisnase v'yishadar v'yisale v'yishalal, shmei dekacho beraku. Leolo minko, brukoso vesheroso, tushbikoso venekamoso, da amaron beomo ve imru omein. Yehe shlomo rabo min shamayo, vikayim alenu ve alkol Yisrael, ve imru omein. Ose shalom bimramov, hu yashe shalom, alenu ve alkol Yisrael, ve imru omein. Thank you very much. We must always remember and honor our ancestors. For who are we but the cumulative total of all of those who have walked this path before us? So it is important for us to honor them because we are literally they. They are us. They are we are they. All right, now, we've been talking about the evolution of Jewish mysticism, and in the last few classes, I presented a brief summary of the historical milieu surrounding the rise of, well, surrounding, first of all, the prophethood of Ezekiel and the historical background and context in which Ezekiel gave his ministry, practiced his ministry, which was largely prophecy, and well, which was prophecy, of course. There were four major visions in the book of Ezekiel that were recorded by his disciples. And largely warnings given to the people of Israel prior to being taken into captivity after the fall of the southern kingdom of Judah around 586 before the Common Era. And then also after that, the history of when 70 years later they were released from captivity in Babylon, returned to the land of Canaan, or Palestine, or Judah, or Israel, the Haaretz, Yisrael, the land of Israel, reestablished Jerusalem, rebuilt the temple that had been destroyed by the Babylonians 70 years earlier. And so around 516 before the Common Era, they built a second temple. And this lasted until the year 70 CE in the Common Era. And this, of course, was during the long period in which Judea was under the control of Rome, the Roman Empire. And at first, It was a client kingdom. It was the kingdom of Judea. But it was a client under the sway and power and influence and really a loose form of captivity to the Roman Empire, to the city of Rome. And but then in the year 1 AD BC or CE, Common Era, that changed, and it was, well, in around the year, I think that was the time it was that it became actually a province. Its status as a kingdom was taken away, was changed, and it became even more under the domination of Rome, in that it became a province of Judea, instead of the kingdom of Judea. And then, of course, there were some rebellions, and they were put down after huge losses on both sides, and they were crushed by the Roman Empire and its legions. And then in the year 70 AD, Common Era, the Second Temple was pulled down and destroyed by the Romans, and the city of Jerusalem was renamed, became a Roman metropolis, and it was, and the Jews were barred, prohibited by Roman edict from even entering into the city. And so during this time period is when the beginning of the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews throughout the world into the nations of the Gentiles. And so this was the background that existed at the time of the second half of the second century Common Era, the time in which Rabbi Akiva lived. And he, as I mentioned before, is the person to whom we can attribute the start or the beginning of Merkaba mysticism, although it's not that simple, really. It's not. There were many teachers who practiced mystical rites and exercises and meditations and prayers in which they attempted to have devakut or cleaving to God, and in which they attempted to ascend up through the heavenly spheres, the upper worlds, in order to be able to view, to see God on his throne. This would be the ultimate thing, to be able to be there among the heavenly choir of angels, to be able to stand at the foot of, or at least of the throne, to be able to stand next to the archangels that flanked the throne on which God, the heavenly king, sits. And this, of course, was the goal. And many, many people did this. So when we say that this Merkaba mysticism, which is what this is, Ma'aseh Merkaba, which means literally work of the chariot, when we say that this can be traced back to the time of Rabbi Akiva around the year 150 Common Era, then yes, that's when scholars can trace it back to, but it doesn't mean that he invented this type of mysticism. So don't confuse those two things. It's just that it's traced back to his time, and he is one of the greatest rabbis in all of Jewish history. And so it's back in his time when this started, and he's one of the main rabbis to whom the work of the chariot is attributed. All right. Now, that's what we've been doing. Today I'm going to start describing what this work of the chariot, this Ma'aseh Merkava, meaning literally Ma'aseh work or deed, Ma'aseh deeds, works of the chariot, what this actually is. So we'll begin to discuss that as soon as I get a swallow of tea here to soothe my throat. That's better. Okay, Maaseh Merkabah, as I just said, means literally in Hebrew, work of the chariot. This is the term used to describe the attempts of the mystics, the Jewish mystics, to achieve a vision of the chariot and of the throne of God, and if fortunate enough, of God himself sitting on the throne. It's the attainment of such a vision that is, quote-unquote, the work of the chariot. So this was the goal of all of the Merkabah mystics. And this is what we've referred to them as Merkabah mystics, just as nowadays we refer to those who do the mystical work of Kabbalah as Kabbalists. Well, we refer to the mystics of this time who focused on the mystical spiritual vision recorded by Ezekiel of the chariot with the throne and God on the throne as being Merkabah mystics. This is how we refer to them. And it's the vision of that chariot and the vision of a throne on it and of God on that throne that those Merkabah mystics sought. Let's talk about this concept of vision a little bit, because this is what they were after. They were after the object of their mystical work. Everything they dedicated, all of their dedication, all of the work that they did, was so that they could obtain this vision. Okay, and so what are we? Let's talk a little bit about this concept of a vision, and I'm going to read to you two passages out of the Tanakh. The first one's out of the Torah. The second one's out of the prophets. The first one is Numbers 23:1. And this is talking about Balaam, and he was a great Gentile priest, and the people who were resisting, the Gentiles who were resisting the conquest of what's known as Transjordan by the Hebrews, by the Israelites, called upon Balaam because he was known as a powerful priest. And ironically, he worshipped the God of the Hebrews. But he was not a Hebrew. And so he was not regarded very highly by the Jews because he kind of represented the Gentile point of view, but he did believe in the God of Israel. Yod-Heh-Vov-Heh, Yahweh, and so the kingdoms that the armies of the Israelite were coming to take, so that they could get the land of Canaan, which was promised to them by God, to their fathers or forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Those people already in possession of that land had to give it up, and most of them fought not to. So they called upon Balaam to curse the Israelites, to bring down God's curse upon them, with the idea that that might help to defeat their armies and preserve to them possession of the land that the Israelites had come to take from them. So in this passage, in Numbers 23, verses 1 through 3, there is talk about Balaam telling Balak what he needs to have done, and that he will go up and consult with the Lord, Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Vov-Heh, and see what he can find out. And here's what it says. Numbers 23, verse 1. And Balaam said to Balak, build me here 7 altars, and prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams. There's some Kabbalistic meaning to this here that I'll talk about in just a second. And Balak did as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bull and a ram. And Balaam said to Balak, this is verse 3 now, and Balaam said to Balak, stand by your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. And he went to a desolate height. Well, what we're talking about here is we're talking about he's going to a place where he hopes to receive a vision of God. Right? Yes. That's what we're talking about. Now, this is before the time of Ezekiel. This is the time when, around 1200, before the Common Era, 1200 B.C., for those of you like me old enough to remember that time of reckoning, that method of reckoning time, this is the time when the Israelite people, the people of Israel, had arrived and were under the leadership of Joshua and had moved across the Jordan River and had begun, and they fought at Jericho and took over that kingdom. And they fought at the other city-states that existed. And they took over those kingdoms. Well, this was during the times of those campaigns, those military campaigns, the time when the city of Israel was coming into the fullness of the promise, of God's promise, in God's covenant with the forefathers. And so Balak is saying, okay, Balaam is saying, okay, Balak, you've asked me to curse the Israelite people. You've asked me to utilize my theurgic influence upon God to act through me, to curse them, to foil their purposes and desires, to cause them to lose to you on the battlefield, or to cause some kind of divine catastrophe to befall them as a result of my curse, which would bring with it the power of the Lord, Yahweh, with it. You've asked me to do this, but I don't know that I can do that. All I can do is sacrifice to the Lord to curry his favor. And so I'm telling you right now, go build 7 altars and prepare 7 oxen and 7 rams and to sacrifice them. And what we have here is we have 3 things in 7 places. We have 7 altars, 7 oxen, and 7 rams. And so in each place, in each of the 7 places, what is there? There's an altar, an oxen, and a ram that's going to be sacrificed on the altar. But there's 7 of these. Okay? So what we have here is the numbers 7 and 3. This is very mystical. He didn't just tell him, go build an altar and sacrifice an ox and a ram on it. He said, build 7 altars, and on each one of them, sacrifice an ox and a ram. So that's 7 oxen, 7 rams, 7 altars. The numbers 7 and 3. What are those numbers Kabbalistically? What is their significance? Well, there's many, let me tell you that, because everything in mysticism is multi-determined, multi-leveled, multi-determined. There's no one answer, and the others are wrong. Here's one interpretation of that, okay? The numbers 7 and 3, what do they represent? Well, get out your diagram of the 10 holy sephirot, the Etz Chaim, the tree of life. And you'll see that there are 10 sephirot. What is 7 and 3? They add to 10. Okay? Those 10 sephirot, these are the stages of manifestation of God coming into the world. Okay? They're also the prototypical architectural design of all creatures in the world. Because of the world and of all the creatures in the world, because we are told that God made us in his form and likeness. In his image made he them, male and female. Remember? Okay, so this diagram of the 10 sephirot is not only a diagram of the stages of emanation, or of God, of the Godhead, containing all of God's characteristics in those 10 sephirot, and the stages in which those characteristics are emanated into this world, but they also are a diagram of our characteristics and of what we look like, of that it's the diagram of how we are laid out, how we exist. Okay? Now, you can divide those into a group of three sephirot at the top and a group of seven underneath them. And I'm talking about vertically now, the way they're distributed. The first three sephirot are what? Keter, which means crown, Chokmah, which means wisdom, and Binah, which means understanding. The three of those are often held by the Kabbalists to be viewed as one, called Atika Kedisha, Arik Anpin. Atika Kedisha means the Holy Ancient One, the Ancient of Days, the Holy Ancient One. Okay? That means the most ancient of our concepts of God, the one who has existed forever, the one who was not created, the one who did not come into being, the eternal. Okay? From which all of creation came. So it's the top three from which the bottom seven came. Another way of looking at those top three is you have Chokmah, which the partsuf for, which means archetypal personality for, is Abba. That the name of that partsuf is Abba, which means father. And to the left of that is Binah, which the archetypal persona for the partsuf name is Ima, mother. So on the right-hand side, you've got father, and the left-hand side, you've got mother. And it's through their union that the birth of the world takes place. And the coming into existence of all things, the cosmos, the individual stars, planets, worlds, galaxies, and all the space and time in between. And then on this planet, all the life forms, right on up the food chain to us. Okay? All came from the union of Chokmah and Binah. What does that leave Keter's role as? Well, Keter is the crown. Keter is the king. You've got the king and then the father. Below the king, you've got the father and the mother. But it's the combination of the king, which another word for which on Keter is will. Will. It's the divine will. It's when God willed the world into existence. That's how creation took place. God willed there to be a universe. And then God said, let there be light. And that's how we all came about. So what we have is the three on the top, from which came the seven underneath, which is all the worlds. And the bottom one of that seven is Malkut, which means kingdom. That's the archetypal, not archetypal, that's the spiritual world that connects between the upper worlds and our world. We're not really even on the map. We're not really even drawn there. If we were going to draw us, we'd have to draw connected, coming off to the bottom of Malkut. We'd have to draw another set of 10 sephirot, only there'd only be 9, because the Keter of that lower group would be the Malkut of the Tree of Life that you're looking at now. In other words, the Malkut of the upper worlds is the Keter of the lower world that we live in. Okay, I hope I haven't muddled that up too badly. But anyway, so all of that is incorporated in this verse, in this single verse, Numbers 23, verse 1. And Balaam said to Balak, build me here 7 altars, and prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams. The 3 times 7. And Balak did as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bull and a ram. And now we'll talk about this next verse. Verse 3, Numbers 23, 3. And Balaam said to Balak, stand by your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. And he went to a desolate height. Okay. So Balaam is saying, you want me to do these things for you, but all I can do for you is what God will do through me. And so to find out whether anything can be done for you, I must go to God and ask for a vision. I will see if I can have a vision. First, we must sacrifice in order to put God in a pleasant mood. Because after all, it's the aroma of the sacrificed flesh, the burning flesh. It's that smoke that rises up to the upper worlds and is pleasing to God. It's the smell. It's not food. Do not make a mistake here and think that sacrifices on the altars, whether it's what this Gentile Balak and Balaam are doing, what these two Gentiles are doing, or whether it's what the Kohanim, the high priests, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is doing inside the temple in the time of Moses, when they're sacrificing in the temple. They're not giving God food. It's not, God doesn't have to have food. What they're doing is they are sending heavenward in a column of smoke a pleasing smell. That's what this is. And that's what we're taught, what's being talked about here in Numbers 23:1, way before the time of Ezekiel. So they sacrifice first to put God in a more pleasant mood. And then Balaam says to Balak, stand here, stand by your burnt offering. Now that in itself is important, because in the book of Leviticus, in the first seven chapters, God gives the instructions, the mitzvot, on sacrifices. And in almost all the cases, when a person brings a sacrifice, wanting something from God, or wanting expiation for his guilt related to a sin against God or to the people, then the person who brings the burnt offering brings it to the temple and brings it to a certain place before the altar and hands it over to the priests, to the Levites, who then take it I think in some of the cases they have the individual do the slaughtering, but whether it's the individual or the priests who do the slaughtering, it doesn't make any difference to me for purposes of this right now. The person stands there, the person for whom the sacrifice is being offered to God, doesn't just hand it over to the priests and leave. The person stands there while it is sacrificed, divided up into quarters and placed on the altar and burned. And this is the same thing that's going on here. Balaam is saying to Balak, stand by your burnt offering, and then I will go. He is the priest. The priest goes and takes the petition, and presents the petition to God to see if God will grant the petition. And he says, you stay here by your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to me, because that's not a given. So perhaps the Lord will come to me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So, and now it says, he went to a desolate height. What does that mean, he went to a desolate height? It means that he went and climbed a mountain. He went up high. By desolate, another translation for the word for desolate in Hebrew is bare. Well, it's not bare and it's not desolate until you get to a certain place, which is higher than the tree line. So he went up onto this high place. Now, is this common or not? Yes, actually it is common. This is where the person who wants a vision of God has to go. Where else do we see this in the Tanakh? Well, in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 5, we find, quote, after that you shall come to the hill of God, the hill of God, where the garrisons of the Philistines are. And it shall come to pass, when you have come there to the city, that you shall meet a company of prophets coming down from the high place with a lute and a tambourine and a pipe and a lyre. before them, and they shall prophesy. They shall prophesy, however you say that. So, it's telling us in 1 Samuel 10:5 that this person shall look for the prophets coming down off the hill of God from the high place. And when they get down, they shall prophesy. Okay, so again, we have this reference to a high place, to a place, a desolate, I like the terminology, the desolate height. And he went to a desolate height. Why is it that we go to look for God at a desolate height? And what does that mean? Does it mean literally we can't see God unless we go to a desolate height? Yes and no. Remember when I was teaching about the different levels of interpretation of Torah? There's the literal external level, the level of the garment, the exterior. Well, on that level, yes, that's what it means. And that's what they did. That's what the prophets did in those days. Think about this. Abraham was lifted up to look down on the world and see the lands that God promised to his descendants. Remember when God makes his covenant with Abraham and he says, I shall make your descendants number greater than the number of the stars, greater than the sands of the sea, on the shore of the sea. And he lifts him up, so he can look down on the world and see all the lands that God promised to his descendants. Abraham talked with God at the Oaks of Mamre. This is a place on a high ridge that looked down upon the valley and the plain that held the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember Abraham's cousin Lot went to live down on the plain at the city of, he lived in Sodom. And then those three angels came to Abraham, who he had remained behind. He didn't go down in the valley. He stayed up on this high ridge, a ridge between two valleys. That's not a very hospitable place, especially in the Middle East. It's a lot desolate. It's a lot bare, very much so. But this is where Abraham stayed with his tent and Sarah. And he circumcised himself. And on that day of circumcision, in the heat of the day, Abraham, in his pain, was sitting at the door of his tent. And in the shimmering heat, he saw three strangers approaching. And he rose up, even though he was in pain, and he ran to meet them. And he said, Lord, Lord, come with me to my tent. Let me wash your feet. Let me fetch you water. Let me slaughter a calf or a goat, I can't remember which one it was, but some meat, and prepare that for you, and have Sarah have her cook some bread for you. And the Lord, who was embodied in those three men, said, be it as you wish, and he went with him. So that was on a high place. Where's another high place? Noah. Noah built an altar and sacrificed to God where? On the top of Mount Ararat, the first land to reappear after the flood began to recede. Thus, it's the highest of all places in the world. It's the first land to reappear after the flood. So therefore, it's the highest of all high places. And what is the first thing that Noah does when he gets out of his ark and stretches his legs? He builds an altar and sacrifices to God. And it says, the pleasing smell of the smoke of the sacrifice of the roasted meat rose up to and pleased God. Moses went up on a mountain. What mountain's that? It was the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. And he saw the burning bush. And that's where it was a vision. It was a vision of God in a thorn bush that burned but was never consumed by the flames. And it was from that bush that God spoke to Moses and gave him his great commission to go and liberate the Israelite people the Jews from the captivity they were being and bondage they were held in by Pharaoh in Egypt. Where else? Moses climbed up after he led them out of captivity. He brought those people. The first place he brought those people to was the foot of Mount Sinai, and then he had them wait down below while he went up onto Mount Sinai with his servant Joshua of Nun, and went up on Sinai and was lifted up into a cloud of smoke and fire where he talked with God, and God gave him the covenant of the Torah. Okay, so there's all these instances of God visions by the righteous, by his priests, by his prophets, by the leaders of the Jewish people. And they all take place up on mountaintops. So God is a God of the mountains. And indeed, some linguists say that El Shaddai actually means God of the mountaintops. And that's where God is found, is to be found. Now, why would that be? Okay, I talked about the levels of interpretation, right? Well, and I just showed you literally that this is where these people through history actually went to meet with God. Okay, but there's another level of interpretation, and that is the mystical level of interpretation. You go down through the level of the garment into the body, and down through the body into the soul of the Torah. And what does it mean when it says, and he went to a desolate height, or they went up onto the hill of God? What that's talking about is entering into, ascending from the level of this world, up into the level of Malkut. Now, as levels of consciousness, all these 10 sephirot on that diagram of the 10 sephirot that you see there can be seen as levels of consciousness. And what the mystic does is rises up through those levels of consciousness. And so the first level of consciousness that one comes from that's not ordinary consciousness is Malkut consciousness. That's the very lowest level. And then after that, one can go up to Isod, and then you can do the zigzag pattern all the way back up. Go from Isod to Hod, from Hod to Netzach, from Netzach to Ferret, and so on. Up to where? Well, the desolate high place, the desolate height, is Chokmah. It's the level of the Father. That's where we encounter God. We're the mystic. That's the highest level that the mystic can encounter God. Very few people ever attain that level. But it's called Chokmah consciousness. It's the level of consciousness in which it's just the beginning. It's Reshit. Its other name is Reshit. R-E-S-H-I-T. That's Tav, the letter Tav. And it's the level in which all of existence is nothing more than a tiny point. It's the tiny point which is like a spring which begins to well up out of the background. And then it becomes a mighty stream. And then into Banah, the mother, and then from Banah, the mother, it separates into four rivers, the four rivers that are talked about in Genesis as being in Gan Eden. But in any event, it's Chokmah consciousness that's being talked about when it says, and he went up to a desolate height. He went up on the hill of God. He went up on the mountain of God. That desolate high place is an altered state of consciousness that the mystic tries to achieve. And where is it at? It's specifically Chokmah. It's Chokmah consciousness. That's the place where we get rid of everything in our minds. It's a position of emptiness. Why do I say that? Because we've been taught in Torah that the beginning of wisdom, and wisdom is the name of Chokmah, right? Or wisdom is what Chokmah translates into. The beginning of wisdom is nothingness, ayin. That's in Proverbs, that we're told that. Ayin is another name for Keter. Keter cannot be contemplated, because that's a mitotic duplicate of Ein Sof, which is cannot be experienced. You experience that, you do not come back. You die. You may not see my face and live, God says to Moses. When he's on Mount Sinai and says, God, let me see your face. And he says, you may not see my face and live, but I will pass by you. And after I have passed by, you may see my back. Okay, so we cannot see or experience Keter and return to this world. It requires our life. It's a level of consciousness that leaves behind the body entirely, and you do not return. It's Chokmah consciousness that's the highest level to which we can aspire. And that's the level in which the mystics, Merkava mysticism, try to reach. It's the vision of God on the throne. Why do I say God on the throne? Because it's Chokmah, which is Abba, which is Father. It's the Father that the so-called Jesus spoke of when he said, it is not I who say and do these things, but the Father who dwelleth within me. That's Chokmah that he's talking about. Okay, so that's what I wanted to talk to you about today, about the obtaining of the vision. And that's what the purpose of Merkaba mysticism is, to obtain the vision of the throne of God. And if you can get high enough to stand before the throne of God and witness God on his throne and enter into concourse with the God on his throne, which would be to enter into Chokmah wisdom. To stand before the throne, you'd be at the level, before the throne of God would be at the level of Tiferet, which is in the world of Berea and Yetzirah at the same time. So Tiferet, Gevurah, and Hesed is the world of Berea, the world of the throne of God, and the mystics could get to there if they worked really hard at it. They could get to there. A select few were able to obtain the level of Chokmah and actually be on the level of the throne of God and possibly converse with the Father, Abba, on the throne of God, who is sitting on the throne of God. So the goal was to attain the experience. That's the goal of Merkaba mysticism, to have that experience. It's an altered state experience. It's not like you're walking down the street and you run into God, or you see a chariot carrying the throne and sitting on it is God. That's not what we're talking about, which I know you know. But it's a mystical experience that's based on an altered state of consciousness, in which you're no longer bound to the physical body and its senses. You transcend that. And it's an experience that's filled with extreme ecstasy, which is one of the reasons the mystics seek it. Once you've experienced it, it is such an incredible feeling of ecstasy and peace mixed that comes out of that, that you want to go back and experience it again and again. And you have to be careful not to fall prey to that, because then that becomes a selfish motivation. It's no longer serving God's will. And then on return to the normal state of consciousness, the Merkaba mystic oftentimes wrote down detailed descriptions of his experiences. Usually these were shared only with a mystic's teacher for purposes of receiving evaluation and guidance. Okay, well, that concludes what we're going to talk about today, and on our next meeting on Wednesday, we will talk some more about the methods and practices by which one achieves such a vision. And because you can still do this today. This isn't something that happened at one time, like prophecy, and it doesn't happen again. An era that's over. It's not the most popular form of Jewish mysticism, but it's been incorporated into and is really part and parcel of Kabbalah. And so we'll talk more about the methods used to attain the Merkava vision, the vision of the chariot, when we teach again on Wednesday at the same time and same place. In the meantime, this class will be rebroadcast tonight at the same place at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Western time, and I hope to see you there. And if you've enjoyed this, bring your friends with you, and we'll see you there. In the meantime, I wish you well. I ask you to remember God at least twice each day. Go from strength to strength. Zygote.